I guess if we've gone through 15 years of that, we've come out the other end and we've still got a half decent business, I think we're in it for the long haul. But gosh, if that's what's happened in the last 15 years, I don't know what's going to happen in the next 15 years, but we're strapped in for the roller coaster ride. And we also love where we farm and being able to raise a family in that environment as well.
G'day and welcome to the Humans of Agriculture podcast. I'm your host, Ollie Lalive. I think this is episode like 140 something, which is just crazy. We started beginning of March 2020 and we've had a huge range of guests since then. I'm recording today's episode on Gadigal country. If you want to check out where that is, jump to Google, type in Indigenous map of Australia. My next guest is Penny Schultz. She's a red meat and wool producer from South Australia, but that's the first of many hats that she wears. She also runs her own consulting business, is a university lecturer, an industry advocate, and just has a couple of advisory roles as well. In today's chat, Penny and I are discussing her journey, and specifically around one of her key areas, which is the ag tech scene. We're chatting about its challenges, its opportunities, and in answer to one of my favourite questions, Penny believes that a key area that we can get better at is promoting and showing young people what technology and science actually goes into agriculture, so we can change people's opinions and perceptions so they can understand more about our sector. I'm going to jump straight into it. Firstly, Penny, what country are you coming to us from?
Narrangeri country.
There you go. Lovely. Penny, you're a red meat and wool producer. Whereabouts is home for you and what are you guys growing?
We are in a little district called Field, which is atop of the limestone coast just off the Coorong. Yeah, sort of between Meningie and Kanowp, and most people don't know where Field is because there's no shops there, so we don't get offended about that. It's a quite a unique little spot, very sandy country, but great climate for growing sheep and beef cattle. And we're all sort of loosen-based pastures and pretty hot summers, but we love farming there.
And how much time do you spend there? Because I looked at your bio, you've got a few different hats that you wear between the farming, consulting, university lecturer, industry advisory. Do you have much time to do much else?
I'm not as hands-on on the farm these days as what I would like to be. Yeah, my husband generally has to book me in if he needs help in the sheep yards or for shearing or weaning, I'm fortunate when I am at home, I can work from home. So unless there's meetings somewhere else, I can work from home, whether that's teaching at university or meetings. And COVID has actually been really good for that. It sort of bridges the divide and forces people to use technology to stop me having to drive around so much.
Yeah, because I see that you're lecturing at the University of New England. So yeah. Pre-COVID, was that flying up there and doing stints in the classroom?
No. So I was pretty fortunate. I started just a little bit of casual lecturing and took on a unit that was always external. So there never was a face-to-face version of it. But yeah, as time's gone on, I've picked up a bit more teaching and I do go up there from time to time now, but a lot of it I can do from South Australia. Sometimes it's challenging to do it online because you've actually got to make more effort to be engaging because you're not in the room with somebody.
Yeah. Oh, ahead of your times there, Penny, and everyone else was just playing catch up while you were just doing things as normal.
Yeah. No. It forced us. It forced everybody to do things better with technology.
Yeah. No, it's been a pretty incredible piece, I think. And like even just looking at how all the different schools, like my little sister's a teacher and how she, started teaching online and incredible.
Yeah, for sure.
And so has this little pocket of South Australia always been home for you or whereabouts did you grow up?
No, I actually grew up in like a rural steel city called Whyalla, pretty infamous in South Australia because it has a big steelworks. Pretty much lived on the edge of the saltbush scrub growing up. And then we moved to Adelaide. I went to an agricultural high school, which was pretty much up my alley. My dad grew up on a farm, but he moved into town with his family to go to school as well. So it sort of skipped that generation, but I just grew my love for agriculture and the environment and science in general, going to high school there. Yeah, ended up moving back to Whyalla for a little bit actually before I started the rest of my career, but it's a bit of a shock when people say, so where are you from? And I say Whyalla and they're like, really? because it's sort of renowned for, iron ore mining and turning stuff into steel and red dust, pretty dry hot place of the state.
Yeah, interesting place. And so your old man wasn't on the farm, but I'm guessing grandparents were in that generation.
Yeah. So they were originally from the mid-north of South Australia. My dad and his family moved around a few farms before they moved into the city to skip their generation. But now dad gets to relive his childhood on our farm. Now that he's retired, he comes and works for us. It is for free, but we pay him in chops and beer pretty much. He comes and drives the tractor and checks stock and stuff for us when we need him.
Unreal. There you go. The true economy.
Exactly. Yeah. Trade and barter.
Do you remember like an early memory of ag that really started to ignite this love for you as a child?
Oh gosh. Yeah, not super early, no. Sort of visiting the odd cousin in the mid-north. But I guess I didn't really understand it then to get that buzz. It wasn't until I went to high school till I actually got hands-on and studied agriculture and realised just how science-based it was. I guess I didn't see agriculture as a science as a child. And, yeah, when you actually learn it at school and with your peers, it really is. It's a very science-based sector.
And so this might be a really silly question, but in terms of an ag high school, does it mean that agriculture is like a compulsory subject for all students, or how does it work?
Yeah, it was compulsory up to year 10, and then year 11 and year 12, you could choose to continue on that pathway or do whatever subjects you wanted.
I was looking at your resume, and it seems like if you look at it, it's like there's absolutely no doubt that Penny was going to end up in ag. Was it the obvious choice for you out of high school to go straight into an ag science degree?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The funny thing was, you know, when you choose your courses for university, the ones at the bottom were commerce and engineering. Like if I didn't get into agriculture, I was going to be an engineer or an accountant. So that's quite funny. I always knew, like coming out, I thought that is where I want to be. And I sort of didn't really have a backup plan. There was so much opportunity anyway, so many different avenues you could go down in agriculture. It was just a starting point going to university.
And do you remember what like the aspirations were in terms of what career you kind of envisaged yourself wanting to go down?
I actually did a major in animal science, but thought I wanted to be an agronomist, and I was for a while. I went down a pathway of pasture agronomy, so I worked mainly with dairy farmers, which was pretty cool. But when I finished uni, despite there being quite a bit of opportunity and buzz around agriculture, it was a drought year. And a lot of the bigger companies that normally took on graduates cut back a lot of their programs because there wasn't much money around. So I actually went and worked on a fish farm for a while. And then as things improved and all the jobs popped back up again, I applied for a couple and got a job as an agronomist in Victoria.
What was it like working in those kind of, I'll say, non-traditional industries, but in you were thinking of going down pasture agronomy path, but then working in the fish side of things and also dairy, like?
Yeah. I'd actually, from a dairy perspective, by the time I'd finished university, I'd worked in a few dairies, including the one at our university, milking cows on weekends and when I wasn't at uni. Yeah, and then I applied for this fish farm job, which was back in Whyalla. So I had, you know, a little bit of familiarity. And I'd grown up fishing and camping and stuff in that area. And, yeah, because I'd actually done animal science, I had done meat production at university. And there was a professor, Wayne Pitchford, and he used to teach us about feed conversion ratios and growth rates and things like that and, you know, being efficient. And that's exactly what the job was. But instead of, you know, having cattle in a feedlot pen, it was fish in a sea cage. And so it was exactly the same principles. Like you just transfer your skills over and learn about fish nutrition and fish health along the way. And, it was a steep learning curve. But, it was a bit of a hoot, actually, being able to go out on the water and participate in research. So we were farming kingfish. And it was a very new industry at the time and almost a bit of an experiment in itself. So it was pretty good fun to be part of that.
That's unreal. Not a good job if you get seasick. Or, like, are they far offshore, the Pens?
Not too far, I guess. And it was in the top of the Spencer Gulf, which is, I suppose, reasonably sheltered as far as sea goes. But, yeah, I do remember some of the guys that used to work on the farm. Like, if I had to go out in the water, they would try their best to try and make me seasick. But some people just don't get seasick, right? But that was me, so.
The joke's on them. So yeah. What were some of these stepping stones that you had? Because I think we'll get to the part of your career which you're in now, which is really around innovation and that side. But you kind of weaved your way through a little bit, picking up some studies, different roles. What were they?
Yeah, I guess that's a good thing about ag, I reckon, is that it's not set in stone. It's not prescriptive. You can, you know, the term in technology development is like being agile, right? And I think careers in ag, you can be agile and change and build skills and take up opportunities. And, yeah, I worked as a pasture agronomist across a couple of states, actually, and I decided, I don't really like this. Like, I was looking at all the agronomists that I used to work with and network with, and they just lived and breathed it. And I'm like, I don't get it. I'm clearly not one of those. And so I decided to change jobs and take on a bit more study, which was through UNE, and ended up doing my master's degree in science and, took on a lot more livestock subjects and I just absolutely loved it. So I ended up working in dairy extension for a while, both for the department and then started my own business as well. And then when I started my own business, I was able to branch out into beef and sheep work as well, not just dairy. But, I loved technology and I loved genetics, which, funnily enough, when I first went to university as a undergrad, I hated genetics.
So what was the driver behind setting up your own business and your own consulting? Like, what was the type of work that you were really trying to get into there?
Some of it was necessity, to be honest. Like like with a lot of government extension services over the years, they've disappeared. Governments aren't investing so much into that space, and there was quite a few of us going out on our own to do that. I was also by then married in 2008. I married my husband Jason, and we started farming with him, and also my mother-in-law. We're in business together, and so you can't move then, right? You can't move the farm like I moved to Victoria or Whyalla to go fish farming. You then have, and I also started a family in 2012, and so you then have to create your own opportunities and almost create your own jobs. Because if you can't move to take up those opportunities, well, I'll just create my own where I am. And so that sort of was the catalyst really to start my own business in 2012. So I could still keep working and still doing the things that I liked, but just in a different way.
Did you find that hard to create your own opportunities and start to get a bit of momentum through your own business?
To be honest, no, that there was a bit of opportunity there. But I was super scared, super worried that no one was going to use me as a consultant, no one's going to use me to do stuff. That sort of imposter syndrome where you sort of think, am I good enough to be employed in my own right to deliver a project? So it took me a year or two to get my feet and confidence. Mm-hmm. Then I realised that was probably a little bit silly, but I think we all go through that, starting our own businesses or ventures or, even as entrepreneurs as well, like taking that leap to just have a crack yourself, particularly if money's on the line too, right? You've got to still earn money so that you can look after your family or pay off your house or, you know, whatever it happens to be. So there's always risks involved in starting your own business or venture.
And so how did you kind of back yourself up? And this is a part that's kind of really interesting for me at the moment, is like early stage when you're out on your own is the nearly like the second guessing that comes into it. Were you crystal clear in what you were trying to do, or did you kind of jump and weave and dodge and duck and everything else in those early stages?
Yeah, I did jump and weave a bit. I had a couple of good mentors. One probably a more formal mentor that I picked up and, you know, stopped and then picked up again with over the years. She's been invaluable. And then you have your sort of unofficial mentors that who may not even know they are. And I think that is absolutely paramount to have, whether you're starting up your own business or, you know, working for somebody else. I think having those sort of people around you is, yeah, you have to. I think you really have to. It's really hard to go it alone. And also surrounding yourself with similar people with similar goals and aspirations makes it much easier. And they always say, you know, it's hard to fly like an eagle when you're surrounded by turkeys. I think that's the saying. So you've got to then surround yourself with eagles, right, not turkeys, so that you can, feel supported and be able to talk to people and have a network.
Yeah, and so where did you find your eagles?
I'm not sure if I intentionally went out to do it, but I'm a member of a couple of rural women's networks. Mm-hmm. And been involved with my local farmer organisation and also people that I'd worked with in the past. So you try and keep all those networks and contacts going because you never know when you need those people that you used to work with or want to work with. In 2014, I was fortunate, and the timing was pretty good, to win the SA Rural Women's Award.
Oh, cool. Congratulations.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. It was a little while ago now. It gave me some confidence and got me in touch with some amazing women both in South Australia and elsewhere. Yeah, and sort of kickstarted a few things as well.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And so when did you start to fall down this path of like the ag tech side? Like, I know, so you studied your master's, you've got a family, you've got your consulting business, and then you decide to go back and do a bit of further study in terms of a PhD.
Yeah.
Things were quieting down a bit, were they, at that stage?
Yes, didn't have enough to do, yeah. I think I've always had a bit of a love of technology and new stuff. My mum worked in IT, actually. She was a IT manager. Yeah, I think in that extension work that I had been doing for quite some time, like the whole point is taking the latest research and innovation and trying to communicate that to farmers. So I was forever seeing the new stuff that was coming in, and there seemed to be this, you know, phenomena happening, which was happening right across the board, not just in agriculture, of turning things into apps. Because if we turn it into an app, you know, farmers will then use it. People will then use it because it'll be easy to use. If we just turn this thing into like an app on somebody's phone, it'll make it easy to use, which isn't always the case. But yeah, so it was like this trend of what was happening. And just in general, farmers are being hit with, new ways of collecting information and apps to fix things or calculate things. And we're almost like being bombarded as a sector. Not always good things. So, you know, once bitten, twice shy, as farmers were being provided with new technology, a lot of them weren't sort of hitting the mark, and it was starting to bug me. So I thought, well, maybe there's something in this. Maybe we can learn from this and set something up. So if tech developers do want to build new apps or tools for farmers, they've got a process to go through to help them be more successful and build things that are more useful and relevant to farmers. And, you know, that's where the PhD started.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because, like, I remember I was helping a mate out for a little while with was either Grain Harvest or Rice Harvest, one of them. And there was like 9 different apps that they were running at the time. There was like the to-do list, there was a tracking app, there was the tractor app, there was the livestock app. And it was like, oh my God, it was like, who's building one app that just kind of comes together? And I guess that's where at that time, that would have been 2019-ish, and it kind of felt like surely a John Deere or someone like that will just grab all of these apps and go, okay, you're coming into our dashboard and make it easier, please.
Yeah, and it's not that easy, but it should be, right, that you pull this stuff together and things just talk to each other. But I think that side of technology is changing, that compatibility or interoperability or whatever they call it, where stuff just talks to each other, because for so long everyone's been so protective of their technology and the data and the information that it collects, and that's been, you know, a company or a piece of tech's edge, is that only I've got this. When farmers are actually saying, no, I want this all to talk to each other, and I don't want to use 5 apps, I want to use 1, to the point where there's now technology and people and companies that specialize in bringing all that information together in one platform, and they've built a business just on that. Like, you know, Peartree, I think it's like Peartree, hats off to them. They've done an amazing job, and it's something that's really needed for the industry. But I almost think it's a little bit sad that we need to have a company that does that for us, because a bunch of other tools can't talk to each other. Yeah, I hope that'll change over time, and yeah, we won't have to have so many, many apps to do what we need it to do.
In big news from us, we're excited to welcome Rabobank as a partner of Humans of Agriculture. So, who have we got from Rabo this week?
G'day, my name's Angus Gidley-Baird. I'm the Senior Animal Proteins Analyst with Rabobank Australia. Just like our great friends at Humans of Agriculture, we also have a podcast channel. And this month, I've caught up with my colleague Lance Zimmerman from the US to understand what's going on in that US cattle market. The US is very important for Australia. It regained its position as our largest beef export market last year. And what happens over the next 12 to 24 months over there is going to have a key influence on the Australian cattle market. Tune in to listen. Search for Rabo Research Australia on your favourite podcast platform and keep up with the latest agri trends. See you at beef.
Through your PhD, or one of the pieces that you published, an article that you published, was around exploring the role of smartphone apps for livestock farmers. So where did you guys land with that, besides seeing just how many bloody apps there were for livestock farmers, which kind of blew my mind when I read that?
Oh, I know. And it chops and changes all the time. I was trying to find when I first started my PhD, you have to do this literature review, and I actually hate reading, which is a bit of a problem. I'm not much of a reader. You know, there was lots of papers written about new apps and things that have been developed for farmers, whether it was in horticulture or turf production or in livestock, and it had been written by the groups that had developed those apps. And they were saying how beneficial they were, and, you know, they're going to be adopted like crazy, and they were so easy to use. But I'm like, who told you that? Who told you they were easy to use? And how many farmers did actually adopt them? So I flipped it and thought, well, I'm going to talk to farmers about what they want apps to do for them, what's important to them when they decide to use an app. And I think a little bit of it wasn't surprising to me, and a little bit of it was. But, yeah, things like money and profitability weren't really high on the agenda for adopting technology. It was more about, you know, making life easier and simpler and more efficient. Making more money and profitability is important for every business, but if you're using technology, it's to solve a problem, so life's a bit easier. That was a key point. And I also looked at the age effect, because sort of been hearing so much. One is that farmers are just not good adopters of digital tech, you know, grates me, and that, you know, older farmers don't use, or, you know, it's harder for them to adopt new technology, and I didn't really believe that either. So I found that farmers actually were very good with sort of smartphones and apps, but weren't really using agricultural apps. But that may have been because there wasn't enough relevant, useful agricultural apps out there. And while younger farmers did tend to use apps more than older farmers, the actual use of apps in older farmers was pretty high. So I just think they're a much more discerning audience, and they've seen and heard a lot of stuff over the years, so they're a harder audience to crack. So whereas, you know, maybe younger farmers may be able to give things a go a little bit, or take on risk a bit easier, or they're a bit more native to digital tech. But I just think I think older farmers are more experienced and are maybe just a harder audience to win over.
And I also think, like, in terms of that app uptake. Like there's that element of risk too. Like if you were to move all your business over, it's like, well, are these startup companies, are they future-proof enough that they're going to exist in a few years, or like where do they stand like?
Yeah, and sort of that reliability and longevity in these things is pretty important. Just like Absolutely. It is cattle as well. So, you know, you want cattle to be happy and healthy and live a long life so that they pay dividends back to you as well. And I think we all want that in the technology that we use too.
Yeah. Now let's talk about South Australia, because one thing which I reckon is cool about South Australia, you guys have, there's quite an innovative little state in terms of what's happening over there. I know there was the different like wine programs, but for you guys, one thing, you've obviously got Evocag coming next year in February to Adelaide, the city of churches, which is pretty exciting. What is the startup ecosystem like down there?
I'm possibly biased, but I think we've got a fair buzz and culture around innovation in ag tech and in other areas as well. We've had the last sort of 3 or 4 years, we've had quite a bit of government support, not necessarily like in funding, there has been some, but encouraging and supporting innovation in agriculture. We have like the Lot 14 precinct, which is, you know, which has also got stone and chalk in it, where there's a bunch of, you know, startup tech businesses that can work side by side and grow and develop. Yeah, I just think it's a cultural thing, and as well as being supported by your local government. And I think because South Australia is a smaller state in terms of numbers, not just in population, but in probably livestock numbers and things as well, I think that kind of forces you to work together and be a bit more collaborative. And we're pretty patriotic as well, so we like to sort of support our own and each other, which also helps with driving innovation too.
That's Lot 14 and then there's Lot 100. It sounds a little bit cryptic, like it nearly like a secret club or establishment.
Lot 14 is like an innovation precinct, and then Lot 100 is like a really cool, cool food, wine, and booze in general. I think it's a great little spot where a bunch of in the Adelaide Hills. So Adelaide Hills is quite a sort of foodie, winey area, and a bunch of sort of smaller and probably younger people, businesses that got together a few years ago pre-COVID, and I think it was probably maybe longer in the planning than we think, but they might not have been able to open a cellar door or a cafe or a restaurant themselves, but hey, let's all get together and build one big one and make it like a destination. And I just think that collaboration culture in our state is really strong. And that's just another example. Maybe I'm happy to take some people there when they come over for a Evocag.
Yeah, sign me up, I'll be there. I think what's so cool about, I'll say, the transition now as well to some of these other like startup businesses, but even like the breweries and the distilleries and stuff that are coming out, it's like their waste products aren't generally like waste anymore. It's now that waste is actually now a value-added product. And like this whole move to circular and just this progressive mindset around food and innovation is bloody cool.
Yeah. And I think in that Lot 100, there's an orchard, a Cerevolo Orchards are involved with that as well. And like their some of their fruit goes into making cider, and like it's I just think you have to, right? And we're all about reducing wastage, about working together, and I think COVID's probably forced some people to do that too. But South Australia's not a big place, but we probably punch above our weight as far as that food and wine scene goes, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I want to know, so you've been in ag for a little while now and a bunch of different roles and a couple of different degrees to go with you. So why is it that you're still so passionate about it today and continue to be involved in it?
Oh, well, no one day is the same. It's just in me. I think agriculture as a sector is really innovative. We've been forced to do it. We battle with changing climates and crazy commodity price fluctuations, and you know, all that stuff sort of forces innovation and resourcefulness and efficiency to happen. Gosh, in my time, I mean, I've been involved in agriculture like for 25 years, but as far as farming goes, probably more like 15 years. If I count when I was the agronomist slash girlfriend on the farm, it's 15 years. And in that time, I've seen the two driest periods on record, and not just driest years, periods with like a drought generally isn't just 1 year. I've seen the wettest year on record. I've seen the highest commodity prices, the lowest commodity prices. I've seen a global financial crisis, pandemics, gosh, like the rise of the social license to farm, like that. When I was at university, we didn't sort of even cover that, whereas it is now in a lot of the curriculum, like we talk about that. I guess if we've gone through 15 years of that, we've come out the other end and we've still got a half-decent business, then I think we're in it for the long haul. But, gosh, if that's what's happened in the last 15 years, I don't know what's going to happen the next 15 years, but we're strapped in for the roller coaster ride, and we also love where we farm and being able to raise a family in that environment as well.
Yeah. No, when you're running through those 15 years, it's like, Jesus, even just the last five, it's pretty wild, isn't it? But yeah, as you say, still operating and still opportunities there. So Penny, you get the chance to go back to high school and chat to your 10 students about careers in agriculture. Yeah. Why would you tell them that they should look at a career in ag?
I just think there's a huge diversity in roles. It's not just being a farmer on a farm. There's just a massive array, and you don't even have to study ag science to have skills that are useful in agriculture. There's lots of training opportunities, both on the job, you know, all the way up to university. And I mentioned it before, but you've got opportunity, well, I think you do, to build and change your roles, whether that's on the farm or in a consultancy role or teaching or something. I think, there is the ability to be agile and change if you're not enjoying your job or things change and your circumstances change. It's quite transferable. And then we're like on a real tipping point of pretty exciting technology advances. It's happening already, but it's changing the face of agriculture and the way that we're perceived. So I think that's pretty exciting when younger people get to see the technology and science that goes into agriculture and even on the farm itself, that changes people's perception of the sector.
Well, and I think it's such a big thing, isn't it? Like even your son with his interest in robotics and things, it's like, well, actually, we're not that far off of having... Yeah, like there already is robotic tractors, the swarm farm tech, et cetera, that's out there. Like it's, yeah, how do you take that interest and imagination and go, yeah, well, absolutely you can do that, but why don't you actually look at doing it in agriculture, because there's so much opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. And to be honest, even at 10 years old, my son's aware of that, and he knows that his skills will be useful in agriculture one day. But at the moment, he just doesn't want to open gates.
the pressure.
There's also lots of jobs. Like the ag sector, it's booming, you know, and it's all over the media that, oh, there's heaps of jobs in ag, you know, from you know, I suppose, almost like no skill kind of jobs right up to CEO level jobs. There's lots of opportunity. So I think that's good. And there's... no issue of location or distance either. So, you know, if you move to a rural community for some reason and you want a job somewhere else, you don't necessarily have to move anymore. So I think, and again, COVID's helped with that, but, those sort of things aren't issues anymore or barriers for people to move into a rural community.
Definitely. Now, one other question I've got, and this is, you can answer it with a question. What's a question that you'd like me to ask a future guest on the podcast?
With a few of my roles, we work in moving towards sustainable farming systems. And that means different things to different people. So, and we've got massive frameworks for this sort of stuff now. And I'm a big advocate for that, don't get me wrong. But what does sustainable farming actually mean? Yeah, I think we're building this stuff for the consumer, and we're building some great frameworks for farmers and industries to work towards. But, yeah, I'd like to pose that question to somebody else, maybe somebody that doesn't actually work in that space.
Mm. No, I will. I'm trying to think who I've got coming up. I've got some interesting bits and pieces. Like, yeah, I'm doing some stuff with the organics conference, and so it might actually be really an interesting space to pose those questions to some people there.
Yeah, that would be cool, actually. Yeah, yeah.
Awesome. Well, Penny, thank you so much for coming on for a chat. I think you've had such a cool and varied career, and just another example of, yeah, what's available in ag, and also too that you don't just have to do kind of one thing either. I think, yeah, what you do is awesome. So. Thanks for coming on for a chat.
Thanks, Ollie. It's been great.
Well, that's it from us for another week. Next week, we're heading out to Dubbo. We're going to sit down with the guys from Little Big Dairy. It is also National Organic Month, so we're going to be doing a little bit about that on our social. So jump on over there, check it out, and we'll have a bit of a teaser for Campbell's episode on there as well. If you're not part of our Humans of Agriculture community group on Facebook, search Humans of Agriculture, our community, and you'll see a few updates in there.
Cheers, guys.
Have a good week. Stay safe, stay sane, and I look forward to chatting next week.